If you take your Bible, we're in 1 Samuel chapter 30. We're 1 Samuel chapter 30, and we're going to commence reading at verse number 21. So this is just following the battle with the Amalekites and the regaining of the spoil. So 1 Samuel 30 and verse 21. And David came to the 200 men, which were so faint that they could not follow David, whom they had made also to abide at the brook Bezor. And they went forth to meet David and to meet the people that were with him. And when David came near to the people, he saluted them. Then answered all the wicked men and men of Belial, of those that went with David, and said, Because they went not with us, we will not give them aught of the spoil that we have recovered, save to every man his wife and his children, that they may lead them away and depart. Then said David, Ye shall not do so, my brethren, with that which the Lord hath given us, who hath preserved us, and delivered the company that came against us into our hand. For who will hearken unto you in this matter? But as his part is that goeth down to the battle, so shall his part be that tarrieth by the stuff. They shall part alike. And it was so from that day forward that he made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel unto this day. And when David came to Ziklag, he sent of the spoil unto the elders of Judah, even to his friends, saying, Behold, a present for you of the spoil of the enemies of the Lord, to them which were in Bethel, and to them which were in South Ramoth, and to them which were in Jatir, and to them which were in Aror, and to them which were in Sifmoth, and to them which were in Eshtemoa, and to them which were in Rakel, and to them which were in the cities of the Jeremelites, and to them which were in the cities of the Kenites, and to them which were in Hormah, and to them which were in Korashan, and to them which were in Athak, and to them which were in Hebron, and to all the places where David himself and his men were wont to haunt. And we end there at the end of the chapter. Now, after the desolation at the start of this chapter, as David and his men arrived home to Ziklag and found their wives and their families gone and their homes burned, things had now by this point turned out remarkably well. By God's grace, David and his men had caught up with the Amalekite raiders and they'd recovered everything that had been taken. And not only that, but they had recovered even more besides. There was further spoil on top of their own possessions that had been stolen. Things had been very successful. All has gone well. But as we come to the narrative again today, we're told about a controversy that started to develop, particularly relating to the spoils of war. What was to be done with these things that had been recovered from the Amalekites? How were they to be distributed among the men? And I suppose the key question is, should the spoils go to the individuals who fought the battle? Or should the spoils be shared among all the people, even those who didn't fight the battle? And it's basically a question, when you think of it, it's basically a question of, should these spoils be shared out on the basis of grace, or should they be shared out on the basis of merit, works? And we see David's godly leadership here as he ensures that the spoils of victory are shared on the basis of grace. So as we look at this narrative together and some of the lessons it has for us, I'm going to title it Sharing the Spoils by Grace. Sharing the Spoils by Grace. Now, as we begin, you'll notice that that wasn't the only possibility there. Think about the opposition to sharing the spoils by grace. You might remember that when David and his 600 men were chasing the Amalekites, they came to the brook Bezor And 200 of those men just simply did not have the strength to go on any longer. So those men had stayed behind at the brook, while David and his other 400, they continued on the chase. Well, now, in verse 21, David and his 400 who fought the battle have come back, and they've come back to that brook. And there's a good reunion as these people go forward to meet David. They salute David. David salutes them. And undoubtedly, there's rejoicing as they see their families again and loved ones. Everything's good. But then look what happens in verse 22. Then answered all the wicked men and men of Belial, of those that went with David, and said, because they went not with us, we will not give them aught of the spoil that we have recovered, save to every man his wife and children, that they may lead them away and depart. Now basically they're saying there, these 200 men, they did not go with us, they didn't fight the battle, so they don't deserve the spoils. We'll give them their wives, we'll give them their children back, but that's it. They don't deserve any more, they don't deserve their possessions back, they don't deserve their property back, they don't deserve anything more from us. We'll give them the bare minimum of their wives and their children, and that's it. Because they weren't with us in the fight. They don't deserve any more. And the way their minds are working, it is all based around merit, about earning, about getting what you deserve. And I suppose that flows from a place of pride, where these men, they're aware that they went with David. Here we are, we went with David, we fought the battle. That they're telling themselves, we did something that they didn't do. We bore the hardships, we earned the reward. They didn't do anything. So they don't earn the reward. It is works-based thinking. And let's face it, the kind of thinking that we see here among these wicked men among David's camp, the kind of thinking we see here can often be very entrenched in our own hearts too. And you certainly see how prominent it is and how easily it comes into our hearts when you see it addressed elsewhere in Scripture. I mean, it was one of the big issues that Christ had to address in the New Testament. Think of how he dealt with the Pharisees, for a start. In Luke 15, the publicans and sinners drew near to hear Christ, and the Pharisees, they murmured and they complained. They said, this man receiveth sinners and eateth with them. Now, if the Lord Jesus had been socializing with the Pharisees and with these respectable religious people, if he'd been paying them some sort of respect, well, they probably would have been a fair bit happier with him. But the idea of him pretty much ignoring them and giving his time and his attention to the bad people, the publicans, the sinners, the people that didn't deserve the time of day, well, that got to them. They don't deserve it. They don't deserve the blessing of God, certainly. They don't deserve any sort of time with him. Why is he showing his time to them rather than paying his respects to us? We deserve more, because look at us with our righteous lives. That was the thinking of the Pharisees. And Christ responded by telling three parables, three well-known ones. He talked about the lost sheep and then the lost coin, and spoke about the celebration when these things were found. He then gave the parable of the prodigal son, and again it built up to where there's this great homecoming and a wonderful celebration. And a legitimate, a good celebration, that the son that, as far as the father was concerned, was dead, is now alive. He was lost, but now he's been found. There's good reason to rejoice, and Christ was emphasizing through the parables that there ought to be joy. To think of publicans and sinners hearing the gospel and being restored to God, there ought to be joy at that. But he doesn't end the parable there. You know, the parable of the prodigal son, it really has its sharpest point at the very end, when the Lord describes the elder brother. That was aimed directly at those Pharisees. There was the elder brother, and he'd been serving his father, he'd been doing outwardly the right things all his years, but he wasn't in a right relationship with his father either, because there he is, sulking outside. He's not willing to come into the celebration. He's not willing to rejoice in his father's presence. There he is, outside, gloomy and grumpy. And he's that way because he thinks he deserves more. That rascal of a son, he left, he wasted his money, and now he's back and you're celebrating. Look at me. Look what I've done. I've been faithful all these years. I've been working here on the family farm. I've been doing all this. He thought he'd done better. And his works-based thinking was actually keeping him from the real enjoyable fellowship at that celebration. That was the case with the Pharisees. Works-based thinking consumed their hearts, and it's that kind of thinking that was keeping them actually away from God. They thought they could stand in their own righteousness before God, and they couldn't. And that kind of thinking is what is entrenched in this world as a whole. But it's not just a problem for the unsaved. It's a problem that creeps into the church as well. You might think of how Christ dealt with his disciples. The same basic kind of thinking can be very present in the hearts of disciples too. In Matthew 19 and verse 27, Peter asked the Lord a question. He asked, "Behold, we have forsaken all and followed thee. What shall we have therefore?" Now, if you're tuned in, you'll notice a bit of a problem with that question. Peter's saying, we've done this. What do we get for it? We've forsaken these things. What have we earned? What have we earned from your hand since we've done these things? Now, when Christ answered Peter, he started off by emphasizing, undoubtedly, Peter and the others, that they would have much more than anything they'd lost for Christ. They would have much more. There was going to be no real loss in coming to Christ and forsaking things. He did emphasize that. But then it was important for Christ to give Peter a bit of a warning. And at the end of Matthew 19, the Lord said to him, "But many that are first shall be last, and the last shall be first." And essentially there Christ was telling Peter, you're not to think of all this in terms of you earning a certain amount. You do more so you get more. That you've given up more than others and therefore you earn more than others. You're not to think about it like that. He went on in the next chapter, and remember, it just flows in. It's part of the same conversation. Chapter 20, Christ went on to give this parable about a master who hires laborers to work in his vineyard. And he goes out at the very start of the day, and he hires some men to come and to work for a penny, for a denarius, as their day's wages, which was a perfectly good wage. And so they come. They're happy with this. Yes, it's a day's work. They come. They're going to do the day's work. But the master goes out again at 9 o'clock, he gets some more. He goes out again at midday, gets some more workers in. Goes out again later on in the day, 3 p.m. or so, and gets some more in. And in fact, the master goes out just 1 hour before it's time to stop work, and he gets some more in. And then the day comes to an end. It's time to pay the men their wages. And to the horror of those who've been working all day, the ones who just did a measly hour's work, they get a full wage. And the ones who worked all day don't get any more. And they're irate. How can they be paid the same as me whenever I've done so much more work than them? Of course, Christ taught that the master was perfectly entitled to give those men who'd worked for an hour an extremely generous wage for their hour's work. And the master had done nothing wrong in giving the original men exactly what he'd promised them. It was a good wage. The master had done nothing wrong. The problem was with the hearts of these men. And Christ was giving the parable to just give the warning to those disciples. Just because you think you've done more and worked harder doesn't give you an automatic right to demand more of God. Doesn't give you an automatic right to expect a higher place, as it were. The Lord finished that parable by again tying it in. So the last shall be first. The first last. For many be called and few chosen. See, Christ looked into Peter's heart there and he saw a real danger. There's a real danger. Peter could start to think, we've done this and we've done that and we've done the other thing. What do we get? And surely if I do more of this, then I'll get more of that. The parable was a warning against this dangerous way of thinking, this works-based thinking that creeps into the hearts even of disciples. And you know, as you think of that parable, I think for most of us, there's a little part of us that understands perfectly well the grief of those laborers in the parable. I imagine most of us could put ourselves in the shoes of those who've been working all day and feeling a little bit aggrieved that the ones who just did an hour's work at the end, that they got exactly the same wage as us. I suspect we can all put ourselves in those shoes and think we would all be a little bit irritated. See, it indicates a way of thinking that creeps into our own hearts. There's this part of us that says, that's not fair. They didn't deserve that. Or I did more and I deserve more. That impulse shows us this way of thinking, it creeps into us as well. This way of thinking that you see among David's men as they're saying, we fought the battle, so we deserve the spoil. We're not going to give those men their possessions back. We're going to keep them. We fought the battle. And how does that show itself in us today? I think it shows itself in a variety of ways. It shows itself whenever we have certain standards that we think are very important. And I mean, even standards that genuinely are important. But then we start to look down at other believers because, well, as if they're lesser believers because, well, they don't quite measure up or they don't stand in the same category as us. I mean, let's take it in our context. Maybe we look down on another believer, perhaps because they don't use the right version of the Bible, or they don't dress like we might want them to on a Sunday, or something like that. And I'm not saying those issues are unimportant, don't get me wrong. But I'm talking here about the kind of thinking that says, I've adopted a more faithful standard, I've done the right thing better than they have, so surely I can look down on them. Surely I'm somehow closer to God, and I can look down my nose. That's what I'm getting at. I'm not challenging those issues that I mentioned, but I'm dealing with this attitude. I can look down my nose because they don't measure up. That's the same kind of thinking that drives David's men to say, we fought the battle, we get the rewards. The thinking can show itself in us when we maybe look around ourselves and we see others whose lives are not, maybe there's things in their lives that aren't good. Maybe there's a sin that someone's struggling with and it's something that we don't struggle with anymore. And again, we take it as an excuse to look down our nose at them. Maybe gossip about them, maybe think ill of them. It's this same workspace thinking. I'm better than them. I've done more than them, so I'm entitled to take the high position. This idea that we deserve more of the credit or something of that nature, because we've done more, it creeps into our hearts in all sorts of subtle ways. Now, be very clear, if you think of 1 Samuel 30, this attitude and this suggestion, it is not a good one. Look at where it arises from. It comes from all the wicked men and men of Belial. There were ungodly men among David's army. And by the way, that's not a surprise. I suppose it's the same in the church too. There's plenty that outwardly are part of the church, but they don't have a heart for Christ, and they're there for all sorts of other reasons. Well, David's army was, there were people there for pure political reasons. There were some there with a real faith in God who knew David was the anointed king. There were others there for political reasons, wanting something better, and all sorts. There were wicked men among David's camp too, just as there are so often in, you could say, in the church today and in other places today. But this impulse arose from the wicked men, the men of Belial, the men of worthlessness, is the sense of that. Then let's think about the importance of sharing the spoils by grace. The importance of this grace-based thinking rather than works-based thinking. I think you see the importance of grace-based thinking whenever you consider the damage of the alternative. Because if you look at this passage, you'll see that this sort of proud, works-based, they didn't fight the battle, so they don't get the rewards, that kind of thinking, it produces great damage among David's men. First of all, it produces a harsh spirit. These wicked men, they're lifted up in pride because they fought the battle. And it leads to them despising their fellow brothers in arms and actually dealing very harshly with them. I mean, look at what they're arguing for in verse 22. Their suggestion is that these people who remained behind at the brook, they get their wives, they get their children, but that's it. They don't get any of their possessions. They don't get their animals back. They're just left to themselves and their families and the clothes on their back. And that's it. Now, you think of how harsh those terms are. And in fact, if these wicked men get their way, then even the Egyptian slave that David and his men found a little earlier in this chapter, you could say, is going to be treated better than those men who got left at the brook because they at least fed him. Whereas these men, take your families, clear off. There's a real harshness here in their dealings with these men. And it's worth remembering why these men remained behind. I mean, bear this in mind. Why did those men remain at the river, at the brook? Was it just that they couldn't bother themselves fighting? Were they treacherous to David's cause? Were they cowards wanting to avoid the fight? Or were they hard-hearted and uncaring about their families that had been taken captive? Well, none of those things are right. Whenever David's forces were pursuing the Amalekites, the men were totally exhausted. Remember, they'd probably spent the last 6 or 7 days with solid marching, with all their gear. And they were exhausted. In the most recent day, you can guarantee it was a quick march, because they're trying to catch up with the Amalekites. And then they get to this brook. And there's the effort required to cross the brook, and it's just too much for 200 of these men. Now, you can be sure they desperately want to continue. Remember, the lives of their families are on the line. They desperately want to continue, but they're exhausted. They just have no strength left. They can't get across that brook. It says in verse 21, they were so faint that they could not follow David. In fact, verse 21 even says of these men, not only does it say they were so faint they could not follow David, it says, whom they, and that seems to be the wider army, whom they had made also to abide at the brook Bezor. So it seems that when these men couldn't cross the river, they were so weak they couldn't make it across. The other men even said to them, look, you stay here. You stay here with the stuff. You guard our equipment and the crossing of the brook. You stay here and we'll go on. Everyone recognized that at that point. These men just couldn't do it. They wanted to. They would have been there side by side with David, but they just physically couldn't do it. And yet, here now David's forces arrive back from the battle, and you've got these wicked men among them. And with their works-based thinking, they've ended up with a very harsh spirit. There's no leniency given to these men, no factoring in of the circumstances, no benefit of the doubt, simply harsh treatment. And you know, that's one of the things to watch for in the church today. Because where this kind of thinking is allowed to cultivate, and we think that we are the superior Christian because we do X, Y, and Z, we do these things, well then we are very tempted to deal harshly with the people who don't measure up. We look at someone else and they're struggling with some sin that we're not struggling with, and we treat them harshly as if they're sub-Christian. I mean, that's effectively what David's men do here. They're saying, they don't deserve any part with us. Sure, they didn't come with us. Well, what harsh spirit can come in our gathering as well if we're not on guard against it? When someone wrongs you and they seek forgiveness, if you have a harsh spirit, well, if you have this works-based thinking and you're saying, well, they don't deserve forgiveness. Well, you're right, they don't. I mean, no one deserves for you to forgive them just because they ask for it. They don't deserve that. Now, don't get me wrong, if you're a believer, you're told to forgive them, but they don't deserve it. So if you're thinking in terms of what they deserve, well, you're not going to forgive them. They should get what they deserve. They should get what's coming to them. They should face my wrath. They should face my bitterness. They should face my opposition for quite some time yet. They don't deserve my forgiveness. You're prone to look at someone's failures and leave off any leniency and any benefit of the doubt and just assume the worst, because after all, they're nearly sub-Christian. That's how this thinking comes in. They don't measure up to my standard. Are they even saved at all? And then flowing from there, and very much connected with that, we could say that this failure, it also produces a divisive spirit. Because you'll notice in verse 22, not only are these wicked men refusing to give the 200 a share of the spoil, but they actually call for those men to be sent away. They say, let's give them their wives, their children, and let them go. Let them lead their families away and depart at the end of verse 22. Let's send them packing. Now, remember the wider context of this, because these 600 men that we're reading about, take them as a whole package. These 600 men have been laboring together with David for quite some time now. I mean, these men assembled with David at the cave of Adullam. And since that time, they've fought the Philistines together. They have fled from Saul together. They've been laboring together and fighting different battles, even from the Philistine territory. These men have had each other's backs for quite some time now. They fought shoulder to shoulder many times. In fact, fundamentally, these men all have the same purpose, because every single one of the 600, they want David to be king. Now, some of them don't want it for the right reasons, but they all want David to be king. They're all laboring to that end, supporting him until the day he's on the throne. Here's a people who ought to be united. They've been laboring together, they want the same things. And on top of that, they're already a little band as it is. I mean, there's only 600 of them. You'd think with such a small gathering, they need to stand together. But this works-based thinking has crept in. The wicked men are saying, no, we fought the battle, they didn't fight it, we deserve the rewards, they don't. They let us down, they don't measure up to us, send them packing. And they're ready to just get rid of a third of their men because they don't measure up, it seems. And, you know, sadly, that spirit shows itself right the way through church history. Now, don't get me wrong with what I'm about to say here, because there are definitely times when separation is important. Our denomination was formed originally when it separated from the Irish Presbyterian Church over some very important issues. I'm not condemning separation under every circumstance. But how often through church history there has been division in churches over the most foolish of things? You know, maybe some issue crops up and people in the church are saying, we didn't like how the elders handled that particular problem. You know, we think that really the way they went dishonored the Lord. They didn't do it like we would do it. And so we're not going to give them the benefit of the doubt. We're not going to have a conversation over it. We're just going to get up and march on out and leave. Or maybe it's not a problem with the elders. Maybe it's a problem with another believer, another person in the church. And instead of sorting the matter out yourselves, trying to give the benefit of the doubt and trying to see the other person in the best light possible, you're saying, well, they don't measure up to me. They're doing it the wrong way altogether. They don't really deserve my time and effort and energies. I'm out of here. Or else they're out of here, one or the other. You know, quite often a spirit of division flows straight out of a legalistic way of thinking. And it's incredibly damaging because it tears the Church of Christ apart unnecessarily. Now, again, I stress there are times when separation is important, and it is important to come away from where there is major error in doctrine and compromise over the core fundamentals of the gospel. There is a need to separate at times. But there are many times when foolish separation occurs, and it's because of this proud, legalistic, works-based thinking where we all set our own standards and we say, well, we've measured up to our standard and they haven't. So they may clear off. We don't want anything to do with them anymore. And that's what we're seeing here among David and his men. And even it happens in little small gatherings where you would think everyone would band together in the cause of Christ, but no, even there it creeps into how carefully we need to safeguard against this. So what is the answer? Well, notice how wisely David handles all of this. And he gives us the real motive for sharing the spoils by grace, and for us, the real motive for dealing graciously with one another. When you look at verse 23, you'll see David's ready answer for the wicked men in his midst. He told them, "Ye shall not do so, my brethren, with that which the Lord hath given us, who hath preserved us and delivered the company that came against us into our hand." Now, the basic thing David is doing there is to remind the men of how wrong their thinking is, especially in light of how God has first dealt with them. Here they are, holding fast to the spoils of war, reluctant to give any of these things to the men who were left behind at the brook, and David points out that they are failing to appreciate. The spoils of war are only possessed by them in the first place because of God's grace. David reminds them, you did not get these things by your own power or your own wisdom. You got these things because God gave them to you. And the Lord had given those things to the men and to David. Remember, we thought of this last week. There's David and his little band of pathetic, tired 400 men. And they chase after this larger force of the Amalekites. And yes, they catch them by surprise at first, but It's not a surprise attack in entirety. The battle goes on for a full day. And there's this little band of tired soldiers who've been marching for the last lot of days, and some of them were so exhausted they couldn't cross the river, and they're fighting this larger force. How did they win? Well, they won because God delivered the enemy into their hand. As David says, the Lord gave them this victory. And therefore, the Lord gave them back their families and the spoils and all these things. God gave it to them. They didn't get it by their own strength. They didn't earn it. God gave it. God gave it. So much of the problem here was that these men had forgotten the grace of God. They thought that their arm had got the victory, that their determination had triumphed. They failed to appreciate it was all entirely of God. And of course, even in that, you could say their attitude was utterly dishonoring to the Lord. It flowed from a place where they were taking God's gifts and pretending they had earned them themselves. But the answer for them was to be reminded that actually they only stood by grace, by God's grace. That was the only reason they had anything, God's grace. And knowing the grace of God to them, the goodness of God to them, that was the motivator for them to deal graciously one with the other. And you know, today, it's the same remedy that we need. It's the same remedy. In the church setting, as we're tempted to set up our own arbitrary standard of where we think we are and lord it over the others who don't measure up to us, as we're tempted maybe through it to slander and gossip and treat others harshly and look down upon them, what we really need is a remedy, a motive for dealing graciously, and that remedy is to continually and freshly appreciate the goodness and the grace of God to you. You know, like David's men, today we only have whatever we have by the grace of God. And wherever we are in the Christian life, maybe there's one here and you're going on with the Lord. Maybe you're going on with the Lord much better than I am. Maybe you're walking closer with God than me. But even still, why is that the case with you? Why is it that you're going so well in your Christian experience? Why is it that things are going so well and you've been growing in grace in these different ways? It's only of God's grace. It's all of His grace. It's because He began a work in you. It's because He's been doing the work in you. It's because He's fulfilling His promises and bringing you through ultimately in glory to perfection. It's all of Him. There's never a time when we can stand back and boast and say, look what I've accomplished. Look how closely I've drawn to God in my own strength. And look at that one who hasn't managed it. I can look down on them. If you understand the gospel at all, you're forced to appreciate that you are what you are only by the grace and the goodness of God. I mean, without His grace, you wouldn't be saved. You wouldn't even be saved, never mind anything else. You only stand today by God's grace. He has delivered the victory to you. He has preserved you, as He did with David and his men. And you know, the more we grow to appreciate that, the more we have it reinforced upon our hearts, the more we're going to be safeguarded from this wrong way of thinking, where we start to imagine that we deserve more because we've done more, that we're better because we've accomplished more, that we can look down on others because they haven't measured up. In fact, we need to be regularly reminded of God's grace to us. David's men here had only just experienced the grace of God, but very quickly, they're forgetting it and taking the glory for themselves afresh and acting as if their arm got the victory. They needed to be freshly reminded. And so do we, regularly. And you know, that's one of the reasons why in the church setting, we never leave the core gospel themes aside. We never leave the central areas of the gospel to one side and go and delve into other areas of theology. Now, of course, there's a place for looking at all sorts of areas of theology as the Bible teaches us about various things. But we never leave the gospel aside to do that. The gospel, week after week, has to be front and center. This reminder of the grace of God that is bestowed upon us continually, that needs to be before our eyes continually. Other areas are important in their place, but we can't leave those themes aside, those core themes. And one of the reasons, among others, one of the reasons is that we need this constant reminder for our heart that we are what we are by the grace of God. We need this constant reminder for our heart that would drive us to deal with one another then in a gracious manner, because we have first and foremost received the grace of God in a remarkable way. So today, do you appreciate the grace of God to your soul? Praise God if you do, and seek to grow in your appreciation of God's grace. Let the knowledge of God's grace shape your thinking and your heart, and then your dealings with those around you, and love the brethren as God has first loved you. Now, as we close, you'll notice that David saw the importance of this, so much so that he made it a law from that day forward in verse 25. He declared in verse 24 that, you know, as is his part that goeth down to the battle, so shall his part be that tarrieth by the stuff. They shall part alike. David saying, we'll share the spoils regardless of who did what. And then he makes it a law. It was so from that day forward that he made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel unto this day. By the way, I think it's quite interesting that David acts very much like a king here. I suppose time maybe has gone by. I'm not sure exactly where this is in relation to the battle the Philistines were fighting with Saul and Saul's death, but here you have David acting like a king. Here he is making a statute for Israel, and he surely knows the time is soon coming when he'll be king. But he's making this statute. It's going to be the case from this time on that the kingdom of Israel, the people of God, that they must be governed by this principle, that they will deal generously and graciously one with the other. And in fact, David does that himself in many ways, because you see at the end of the chapter, he sends from his portion to all these different places, people who've helped and places he's been, and he gives a portion to all these people from Judah. But he establishes this principle. His kingdom is to be marked by this principle. Gracious dealings, one with the other. Now, we might not be fighting literal battles today and sharing out the spoil from a raid. We're not going on a raid down to Port Lincoln to pillage and bring some goods back that have been stolen from us and spread them out. But we are to be a kingdom under the greater David, under Christ, a kingdom which knows the grace of God to us and appreciates the grace of God to us, and therefore reflects the grace of God even as we deal with one another. And as we do so, may God be glorified, may Christ's name be exalted, the church strengthened, and may the gospel go forth. Amen.